and welcome to another episode of the El Qasimi Foundation podcast, a monthly podcast about research, education, and the arts in the UAE. I'm Ethan David Lee, and on this episode, I'm joined by Professor John Burt of New York University, Abu Dhabi, to talk about the importance of coastal ecosystems and the use of artificial reefs in the Arabian Gulf. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So, John, you've been living in the UAE for over a decade now. You're currently an associate professor of biology and program head for environmental studies at NYU Abu Dhabi. And before that, you were an assistant professor at Zayed University. You currently lead the NYUAD Marine Biology Laboratory, and you are the co-principal investigator of the NYUAD Water Research Center. And more recently, you've been a visiting scholar at the Al Qasimi Foundation, where you've published a policy paper titled Policy and Management Considerations for Artificial Reefs in the Arabian Gulf, with your colleagues Dr. Aaron Bartholomew and Dr. Louise Firth of the American University of Sharjah and University of Plymouth, respectively. So needless to say, you are an expert, and as expert as it gets on the matters of marine biology, coastal ecosystems, and artificial reefs.
Yeah, it's been a dozen years since I joined NYU Abu Dhabi, and in actuality, I was the very first faculty member based here in Abu Dhabi when we started this institution. I was here in 2009 before we even had our temporary campus, and I've been delighted to watch the institution grow as well as see things change for the better in the UAE in terms of the environmental movement. So delighted to be here chatting with you folks today.
We're really excited to get to know you and your research a little bit more, and then the research that you've been doing more specifically with the foundation. But you know, before we dive into that, the policy paper, I'd like to, if you could just briefly introduce us to your work as a whole with coastal ecosystems, marine biology, and artificial reefs, just so we can kind of get an idea of what it is you kind of do on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. So I run the marine biology lab, as you said, here at NYUAD, where we've got a team of about a dozen people working on various marine ecosystems. So a lot of people, if you think about the UAE, most people, when they think of the Emirates, would think of sand dunes, maybe skyscrapers, depending on what your perspective is, possibly the mountains, and that would be about the extent of it. But in actuality, we've got a rich mosaic of ecosystems along our coastline that have all sorts of value in terms of biodiversity, but also commercial importance. So, for example, we have Sabkha ecosystems, which are salt flats. We have mangrove forests across all of the Emirates. We have 4% of the entire world's seagrass beds, for example, just here in Abu Dhabi alone. And we also have coral reefs, and these are the most thermally tolerant coral reefs in the world. So they're a really important asset for global science on climate change. So, you know, in my 12 years here at NYU Abu Dhabi, I'm now over 110 publications that we've pushed out focusing on these reefs, and our work has been cited well over 4,000 times now by the international science community. So this place is really fascinating from all sorts of different perspectives. There's the science value, there's the biological benefits that these ecosystems have, but also their value for humanity.
Yeah, and we're glad to join that 110 plus publications. So more specifically, you know, your work with the Marine Biology Laboratory and the Water Research Center, like, I know the latter involves looking at ways to improve the environmental sustainability of the desalination process, which is obviously a huge thing in the UAE. But can you dive into that a little bit more about what exactly your research and your work involves with these two groups?
Sure. So in terms of the Marine Biology Lab, our focus in our research is mainly on looking at how organisms cope with and respond to extreme environmental conditions. So this could be temperature, for example, with the corals and the reef fishes, could be salinity as well. So we're incredibly interested in, I've got a five-year project on mangroves going on right now where we've already sequenced the genome, and we're looking for signatures of adaptation in that genome for the extreme environmental conditions that we have here. And we're seeing things like heat shock proteins, salts, ways to sequester and get rid of salts and so on. So that's a lot of what the work in the Marine Biology Lab is about, is thinking about, okay, if we have a climate that's changing on a global scale, what can we learn from this uniquely hostile body of water that we have in the Arabian Gulf, which is already the world's hottest sea every single summer? The Water Research Center is a divergent project from that, in that it's much more of an applied project. So in the Gulf, we produce over 50% of the entire world's desalinated water every single day. So it's an incredibly important industry around here, obviously for water security, but also for the environment, because you're taking water out of the sea, mm-hmm. turning it into a very salty brine that is then filled with chemicals, for example. So they have antiscalants, antifoulants, biocides, et cetera, that are added to this water to keep the pipes running smoothly in these facilities. And in some cases, if you're using what's called multi-stage flash distillation, you're also heating that water up by 10 degrees Celsius or more, and then putting it back into the sea. And so that have all sorts of environmental impacts at the outfalls. And so what we're doing with the Water Research Center project is trying to understand how we could do these. Well, number one, trying to understand what our impacts are. There's surprisingly little research on the Gulf ecosystems and the impacts that desal is having, full stop. But then trying to improve how we can manage these systems while still ensuring that we do have water security here in the Emirates, for example.
And I know you've come up to Ras Al Khaimah in the Northern Emirates multiple times to have these conversations with the policymakers here. And I was wondering if you could you share some of that, the work that you've been doing sort of in the Northern Emirates?
So a lot of the work I've been doing in the Northern Emirates has been focused on artificial reefs, the topic of our conversation today. So when you think about coastal changes that are going on, there's a lot of movement, not just in Ras Al Khaimah or Dubai or Abu Dhabi, but across the Gulf and even around the world, towards trying to mitigate impacts to natural habitats or compensate for impacts to natural habitats by putting in artificial infrastructure. And so I've been having conversations with folks up there about considerations that they need to have when trying to formulate these programs. It's a lot more complicated than people think. And we'll get into that a little bit more today.
But first, kind of more from a personal standpoint, where did this passion for coastal ecosystems and artificial reefs come from, and how did you end up in the Arabian Gulf of all places?
Well, it's an interesting story. So my father was a school teacher, and at the time my mother didn't work. She took care of us. And so my father was a sailor. He took the meager savings that he had and he bought a small 28-foot sailboat. And so at the last day of school every year, all three of us kids would get hauled onto the boat and we'd pitch off the lines and we'd be gone for 2 months. And so I grew up in Eastern Canada on the Atlantic coast, and we'd go sailing for 2 months straight every year, coming back just the weekend before school started again. And so that gave me a lifelong passion for marine systems broadly. I'm a sailor myself today. I own a much bigger boat than my dad did. I enjoy sailing here in the UAE, where the weather's a lot warmer than it is in Canada, even in the summertime. And so I still have that passion for just being out there experiencing our marine systems. Mm-hmm. Also, I've brought to that my interest in science. Now, I did my undergraduate degree mainly focused on freshwater lakes in Eastern Canada. Then I went and did my master's degree, where I focused on the Great Lakes of Canada and the United States and looking at indicators of pollution. So I was using insects that live in the waters there as indicators of pollution. But I remember being out, I guess it was 1996 or 1997, and it was November, and we get these horrific gales in November on the Great Lakes of Canada. And so sitting on a Coast Guard vessel, massive, like 100-foot or 30-meter-long vessel, heaving over the side of it in these huge swells in the storm in the middle of the night and vomiting off the side of the boat. And that's when I decided I no longer wanted to work in the temperate systems in the Great Lakes and decided to go move towards the tropics. So when I did my PhD, I did field research down in the Caribbean, doing stuff on coral reefs because I was a diver at that point. And we step off from there. What first brought me to the Gulf was actually I was working with a group from the United Nations University at the time, and we were basically brought over to try and develop a coastal management plan for Dubai. So as you're aware, we've got all of these massive offshore coastal developments that occurred in Dubai back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s. And, you know, these were designed by engineers and architects with no real thought to the biology. But when you put anything in marine systems, it becomes a living and breathing organism of its own. And so there were some issues that were going on with some of these. So there was a team of 10 scientists, including myself, who were trying to understand these systems and manage them a little bit better. That brought me to the UAE. At the time, that project was closing up. NYU Abu Dhabi was opening, and I just transferred easily from there to where I am today.
Well, yeah, as you say, I can imagine the, first of all, the sailing in the UAE, the season's a lot longer and certainly warmer than Canada. But you know, you gave an example there of some of the field work that you do, and I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit more information about what is that hands-on work that you do. What, when you go out to the field, and you know, and you're diving, you're sailing, or whatever it is, what does that look like?
Well, I guess it was Albert Einstein, I believe, who said that science is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration, and that's what we do as well. Our team is out there, you know, we'll get up at 5:30 in the morning, get out on the boats early because we tend to have winds in the afternoon every day here in the UAE. And so we're out on the boats early. And if we're doing work on coral reefs, for example, or with reef fishes, we're down there on the bottom for several hours a day, collecting fishes, collecting corals, surveying them, whatever it is that we're doing. If we're in the mangroves, we have a smaller boat that's called the RIB, rigid inflatable boat that in really shallow waters with that. But we're doing this year round. So when the air temperature is almost 50 degrees Celsius, we're out there doing it. In the dead of winter, when the water is in the low teens, we're also out there doing this. So the field work here is gnarly, but we enjoy it. And we'll collect our samples or collect our data while we're out there, come back and spend the afternoons in the lab processing samples or on the computer processing data.
And what would you say is the most exciting part of your field work? What is it that you know, when that moment happens, you're like, yes, I'm so happy to be doing this?
Well, I'd say it's actually not the field work that I find most exciting, like that comment. But, you know, I get people inviting me to go for a dive on the weekend, and that's like asking a mailman to go for a walk. To me, in the sea is actually work. What I get the most enjoyment out is actually increasing awareness. So I very commonly give probably once every 2 months or so, I'll give public lectures on various topics. So just the last month I gave at the Dubai Offshore Sailing Club, I gave a talk on, you know, the environment of the Arabian Gulf and the ecosystems that are associated with it. A few months before that, I gave one on the importance of reef fishes for understanding climate change in the Arabian Gulf. And so I'm constantly giving these talks to the public. And I find it amazing because, you know, I still meet people who don't even know that there's coral reefs here or that we have these massive seagrass beds that are super for supporting things like, you know, we've got the world's second largest population of dugongs or sea cows here in Abu Dhabi. We've got these massive numbers of green turtles, which is an endangered species globally, but here they're very abundant. So, you know, we do have these incredible ecosystems around here, and I like just getting the public aware of these.
Yeah, certainly the UAE is very unique when it comes to its ecosystem, not even just in marine life. It's, as you said earlier, the mountains, the desert, and it's certainly something worth spreading awareness around and getting to people who really appreciate. Which, you know, of course you've been doing hopefully through this podcast and then through your paper as well. So, you know, turning our attention to that, quite early on in the paper, you say that the coastal ecosystems are the most ecologically significant habitat of the Arabian Gulf nations. Can you talk a little bit more about why you think that's the case?
Well, so going back to my initial point about when you think of a place like the UAE, you think of these desolate deserts and these dry mountainous areas. And if you think of the surrounding nations, you'd have the same sort of perspective in your mind. If you think of Oman, Bahrain, et cetera. But when you get into the marine systems, you start seeing very productive ecosystems very quickly. As soon as you hit the coastline, you're going to start seeing cyanobacterial mats, which are photosynthetic. And so they're producing a heck of a lot of energy. So are the seagrass beds. So are the mangroves. So they're producing all this energy through photosynthesis and then releasing that energy into the surrounding ecosystems through food webs. You know, when mangroves lose their leaves or seagrasses have leaf loss, those will get broken down by things like crabs and various other organisms who are eating them themselves. And then those products will then go into things like the worms and the snails and so on, which are then eaten by fishes. And so we do have these long and quite diverse food webs in these systems that are incredibly important, not just for the biological value, but also for things like fisheries. You know, when you come to the market and you see a hamor there, that hamor is not coming from a fish farm, it's coming from the sea. We're just starting to learn how to farm hamor. And so when they're coming from the sea, you've got to think of where did they come from? You know, when marine organisms have what's called most marine organisms have what's called a two-phase life cycle. So they have a adult phase, like you can think of a hamor or a coral, where they're largely sedentary or sessile and staying in one specific location. But then they'll produce eggs that get fertilized and will drift. And those can drift, if you're talking about a fish, tens to hundreds to even thousands of kilometers over the period of at least a few weeks to several months. And so we've got this mix of larvae that are out there drifting around as plankton in the water and keeping these ecosystems all connected with one another from here in the UAE up to Kuwait and outside into the Gulf of Oman. And so it really is almost like a living organism of itself that's constantly interacting. And you've got these source sink dynamics that are going on with each supporting each other.
Wow, yeah, that's super interesting. But maybe like looking a little bit closer at Ras Al Khaimah, when we say coastal ecosystems here, what is the makeup of that specifically here?
So the ones that people will be most familiar with in Ras Al Khaimah will be the mangroves, of course. Now, the mangroves are under a bit of pressure because you've got encroaching development coming from almost all sides where the mangroves occur in the Northern Emirates. But you also have very interesting coral reefs up there. So I've personally dove on the reef that's outside Galila. I've dove on the Sakhar Port breakwater, and I've dove on some deeper reefs that are offshore. And one thing about the UAE's Arabian Gulf coast is that for the most part, it's extremely shallow. Like most of the reefs that I dive in Abu Dhabi are on the order of 4 to 5, 6 meters, maybe. Virtually nothing here is over 10 meters. When you get up to Ras Al Khaimah, you've got some shallow ones that are at 4 or 5 meters, like I'm used to, but you also have some that are at 35 meters, 40 meters depth that are deep offshore. And so they're really interesting from a biological perspective. And I can say that when you look at the Arabian Gulf coast of the UAE, the highest diversity of both corals and fishes occurs in the Ras Al Khaimah reefs. And that's
Oh,
simply,
wow.
you've got much lower, what's the word I want to use? So, or a much more benign environment there versus what you have in the very shallow southern basin of the Gulf towards Abu Dhabi, for example. Because you've got deeper waters around you, it allows some cool, deeper waters to sort of mix up with the surface water to keep it cooler up your way. So it's a really unique ecosystem up there.
Yeah, and you mentioned just then about urban development being one of the big threats to this ecosystem, but what other risks do we really need to be concerned about currently and into the future?
And I don't think this is just Ras Al Khaimah or the UAE. If you look across the region, I would say the primary threat to coastal ecosystems, and remember, these are mosaics of interacting ecosystems. You're looking at dredging and reclamation as probably being the biggest threat. Now, that's going to be reasonably localized, but when you think about the scale of industrial developments, for example, port facilities, how like we need power, we need desalination for getting our drinking water in a place where it never rains or virtually never. And we need to dispose of our waste through sewage treatment plants. All of this requires infrastructure. And then add on top of that things like coastal defense. When you put out breakwaters to protect ports, jetties, and so on to allow access by ships, all of this is modifying that coastline. So coastal development writ large is probably the number one issue that's affecting coastal and marine ecosystems in this region. But layered on top of that is, of course, global scale climate change. We're not really worried about ocean acidification because the chemistry of our water is quite unique. And so ocean acidification is not going to be a problem here for a very long time. What is a pressing threat, though, is global warming that comes with climate change. And that's simply because we already have the world's hottest sea here in the Arabian Gulf. And if you add another just fraction of a degree on top of that, you can start seeing ecosystems undergoing collapse very, very rapidly. And so it's important that we try to manage these systems very effectively because they are so vulnerable to climate change on top of these local pressures.
One of the other concerns you mentioned in your paper was fisheries. Can you expand a bit upon that?
Yeah, fisheries are another threat. When you think about here in the UAE, out of the top 10 fishes that are collected commercially, seven of them are considered extensively overfished. So they're functionally collapsed stock. The other three are considered marginal. And so of the top 10, all of them are considered to be heavily overexploited. And so this is a concern, obviously, because while aquaculture does have some benefits in terms of replacing those, aquaculture comes with its own threats, right? Like when you concentrate fishes in one area and fishes are defecating, you get nutrient pollution, and that can lead to eutrophication, algal blooms, problems like that. you can get infestations of sea lice. And sometimes with aquaculture, you get those organisms escaping into the wild and interbreeding with local species, which can cause its own issues. And so fisheries here, you know, culturally, it's been very important. Commercially and economically, it's been very important. And so fisheries still are a massive political issue. And the management of fisheries has not been as strong as it could be historically.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of the policy recommendations you make around that and other attributes a bit later. But I think now, you've mentioned some of the concerns we have around preserving the ecosystems, and we'll get into artificial reefs after this. But I'm wondering if you could also talk about, aside from artificial reefs, what are Gulf nations currently doing to help protect the marine ecosystems against climate change, against marine management, and against the urbanization that you mentioned?
So one thing that's happened, and this is common across all of the Gulf nations, is that the pace of development has very much exceeded the pace of regulation and management of coastal ecosystems. And so development and economic growth has often come to the fore instead of environmental management. That's an issue because once these ecosystems become too degraded, ecosystems are resilient. They can take some disturbance and some stress and then come back to their original state. We call that hysteresis in ecology. And the problem is that if you put too much pressure on them, they can go to an alternative state. So coral reefs can go from being coral dominated to algae dominated. Once they become algae dominated, it's virtually impossible for them to come back to be a healthy coral reef unless you have decades worth of time to let recovery occur. Mm-hmm. So management here has been very slow and often very weak across the entire region to respond to environmental change. That has been changing a lot in the last 5 to 10 years. It's dramatically improved, and we see a lot more action in these areas. Probably the primary tool that's used across the region for marine management is one that a lot of people think is easy, which is developing marine protected areas. And you think they're easy because you take out a map and you can draw a box and say, okay, we're going to make that area protected. And there's going to be no fishing, no industrial development, et cetera, in this area. The issue is that, going back to my comment earlier on the two-phase life cycle of marine organisms, where do you put these? Is often very complicated. Do you put them around the area that has the highest biodiversity? Well, the highest biodiversity, but it's actually supporting some systems farther away through larval supply that are lower in biodiversity. So maybe you should build a network of these. Well, if you're going to build a network of marine protected areas, do you build many small protected areas or do you build a few big ones? Well, it depends, I guess, on which species you're looking at conserving, right? And so there's many layers to this process of developing marine protected areas. Here in the Gulf region, I haven't seen a lot of science behind the decisions in terms of the design of marine protected area networks.
Right.
It's been mainly political and mainly driven by ensuring that they're hitting international obligations. So for example, the Aichi target, 15% of your marine territory protected. So there are currently a lot of box drawing, by the biology of the organisms that they're actually trying to conserve.
Well, talking of international agreements and political decisions, you know, we're recording this just a few days after COP 26 has ended, and the UAE announced that they'll be hosting COP 28 in 2023. If COP 28 was happening today, what would you want to tell to the politicians and policymakers who are attending?
Well, I think what I've always found fascinating here in the UAE is, obviously, it's a country that's made its income largely off of oil and gas production and the spinoffs from those. And I think the UAE has made great strides in terms of trying to diversify away from that sole source of income. And they're looking very strongly at alternative renewable resources that we can tap, both for financial and energy purposes. I would like to see some development of policies and regulations around building codes here, for example. When you think about where are we using most of our energy in the UAE, probably the vast majority of it, I don't have the specific data, but the vast majority of it is going to desalination, probably, as well as to air conditioning units in homes, industries, buildings, and so on. Yet we don't have very strong regulations on things like using insulation as part of the building codes here. So if you can insulate houses in Canada against the cold. You can also insulate here against the heat, but it tends not to be used widely, particularly in domestic homes.
Mm.
It is in some commercial outfits. On top of that, when you think about desalination, where is most of that water going? So something like 70% of the fresh water in the UAE is still going towards agriculture. Some of the agricultural policies are propping up plants that aren't necessarily fit for this environment. So that's something that could be done. We could also look, I think, very strongly at reuse of water. So there's culturally across this whole region, there's a little bit of resistance to reusing wastewater for drinking water, but that's widely used in many parts of the world. And currently we're only reusing about 5% of the water that goes out as waste. The rest of it gets dumped into the sea or into the desert. That could be very widely used again for irrigation purposes, let alone for drinking water. So that's something I'd like to see grow, which will reduce the UAE's carbon footprint significantly, very rapidly.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, Arabian Gulf countries and especially the UAE, I think the per capita carbon footprint is some of the highest in the world.
That's correct. Yes.
So, you know, moving now on to our big topic, our artificial reefs. Can you, first of all, just introduce us to, you know, when we say artificial reef, what do we mean? And what exactly is its history in this region? Obviously, more recently, they've been quite widely used. But if you could just delve a little more into why that's now the case.
Sure. So artificial reefs have been used here in the Gulf for centuries. We've got going back almost 500 years from the oral records of people going out with the trunks of palm trees, taking them out and sinking them in the sea and putting up a pile of these palm trunks, and then passing these down through family lines through what's called the Sanat al-Bahar, which is the code of the sea. And so these were really family driven, largely for the purposes of aggregating fish for fishing purposes so they could get food. But it's been going on in this region for many, many centuries. Artificial reefs are basically anything that you put in the water that's not natural. And so it's an intended process typically, although sometimes it's accidental with things like ship groundings, for example. Mm-hmm. But largely this is intentional and it happens for all sorts of different purposes nowadays. It could be for fisheries purposes to enhance your catch. It may be to protect an area from trawling, for example. So if you put down some artificial reefs and someone comes along dragging a trawl net and it gets caught up there, they're not going to fish in that area anymore, right? Because of the cost to them. And it may be simply for recreational purposes, diving, snorkeling, etc. And so there's all sorts of different reasons that these have been built. And here in the Gulf, we've seen rapid growth of them in the last few decades. So this is largely because of the degradation of the coastal ecosystems that we've seen as a result of development and so on. There's been a movement by policymakers and marine managers across the entire Arabian Gulf region to start using artificial reefs to help fishers ensure that they're getting enough catch so they can maintain their income, or even to aggregate fishes in a certain area for recreational purposes like scuba diving and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been very widely used across the region, and we've seen exponential growth in artificial reef programs in the last two decades.
But of course, as you point out in the paper, putting so much of these artificial reefs in the ocean then has knock-on effects as well. So can you talk then a little bit more about what are the potential consequences and what do we really need to be aware of when we're putting non-natural things in the ocean?
Well, I think first, it's important to think about what are the possible benefits that these might provide before we think about the cost. So like when decision makers are talking about putting in artificial reefs as some sort of mitigation or compensation for impacts that are happening in natural ecosystems or to help with fisheries, well, we do know that artificial reefs do attract fishes. So fishes, biologically, if you take a concrete block and stick a rope with a float on the top of it and drop it in the sea, within 10 minutes, you're going to see fish going around it. We call them fish aggregating devices, like three-dimensional structure. And when you think of the sea bottom around this region, it's largely sandy and muddy and flat. And so if you put any structure there, fish will come. They're very curious about it. And so they'll naturally sort of move to that area very, very quickly. And as that, you know, artificial reef starts maturing, you're going to get things like oysters and sea urchins and various other things colonizing it, which serves as a food source for those fishes, right? And so you will get communities that develop on these, and they can be quite diverse. Like, I've published a number of papers myself showing that artificial reefs can develop densities of corals that are comparable to natural ecosystems. They have fish density and diversity that's comparable to natural coral reefs. And so they really can be ecologically important. You know, when you think about the oysters and stuff like that, they're filtering the waters that are around there. So it could potentially clean up those waters. And you do see really high biodiversity in these areas. And on the recreational side, if you build them quite shallow, you can turn them into, like Dubai has, one of the artificial reefs there is actually a surfing site. So it's both protect the coastline from erosion, but recreational purpose in terms of surfing. I've talked with people in Ras Al Khaimah about potentially building an artificial reef there as a ecotourism site for divers and snorkelers. Right. You know, they can also, from the perspective of getting people in the water, enhance awareness of marine systems and their importance. So artificial reefs do have a lot of benefits, but they also do come with some costs, as you're alluding to. And those costs can be quite significant. When you think about the process that I talked about earlier with fish, well, if fish are really attracted to these areas, what's going to happen when you build an artificial reef is, instead of having fishes spread over, let's say, 5 square kilometers of sea bottom, they're all going to be curious about this thing and they're going to migrate in. Well, that's good in one instance for the fishers, but bad in another, because it makes it easy and very cheap for you now to collect a lot of fishes. And so initially you're going to see catch of whatever stock it is that you're trying to fish going up, and the fishers are going to make a lot of money that particular year. But because all the fishes are concentrated in that area, it's very quickly going to lead to overfishing and potentially collapse of these stocks.
Right.
And once they've collapsed, there's very little chance of recovery. Even if you're getting larvae coming from another area, those larvae, again, are going to be attracted towards the artificial reef, and this vicious cycle will just continue. Other issues with these is that, you know, often you're going to see them colonized by very different communities. So yes, we may have comparable diversity of corals and we may have comparable diversity of fishes, but you get very different types of fishes being dominant on artificial reefs versus what you see on coral reefs. And in particular, things like predators are very common on artificial reefs versus what you see on natural coral reefs, because they like the complex three-dimensional structure, which comes out of the sea bottom. So they, you get all of these predators circling around it or sitting on the bottom, like a grouper, like Homor, which then of course really changes the prey community that's in that area. They can also have halo effects. So, you know, if you've got this concentration of fish in that area, they're all defecating. So the nutrients are going into the surrounding environment. You also have, because of the changes in the way the water moves around these structures, you can have that changing the sediments that are surrounding these areas, which of course will affect any organisms that live in those sediments. And a lot of these, because we're building so many of them now, we call them stepping stones for invasive species. Because, you know, if you think of sea bottom, it was largely sandy and muddy with no hard bottom. And now we're seeing it sort of colonized by all of these artificial structures that can act as stepping stones for these invasive species. Because if you think about the Arabian Gulf sea bottom, naturally it's all sandy and muddy, very little three-dimensional structure. We now put in this hard bottom, these hard bottom structures every couple of kilometers. And so we can get these organisms hopping from one to one and spreading along the coastline very quickly as invasive species coming from other parts of the world. And we are having issues with invasive species here in the UAE that are largely unrecognized by the general public. And think about, again, the whole point of this being mitigation or compensation and marine management. Well, think about most artificial reef programs across the world, as well as here in the Arabian Gulf. Typically, they're really small in size. They might be 100 square meters, 200 square meters, versus the size of natural coral reefs or seagrass beds or any of these other natural habitats. So they're, because of their small size, they're probably not meeting their ecological goals either. And then, you know, in terms of policy and management, many of these artificial reef programs are just being put in place without any really clear goals. So is it to enhance fisheries? Is it to have a recreational site? Is it to protect a natural habitat that's nearby? Many of these goals aren't really clear. And if you don't have clear goals, how are you going to assess the effectiveness of these structures at meeting those goals. So there's a lot of risks that go with using artificial reefs as well.
Mm-hmm. So you know, as you're saying, there's artificial reefs have huge benefits for ecosystems when it comes to, you know, fishing, when it comes to ecotourism, when it comes to preserving the marine life, and you know, it, from many different facets. But we don't want to implement them without, you know, discussion with people who are experts, without considering potential consequences. And then ultimately, we don't want to be implementing them to, one term you use is greenwash, to ignore the actual issue and just put it as a stopgap. You know, moving on to that, can you maybe talk a little bit more about what your recommendations are for the policymakers? You outlined six within your paper. If you can maybe expand upon those.
Yes. Yeah, so we come up with six recommendations for folks in the region who are considering the use of artificial reefs for policy or management purposes. And the first one, as you correctly pointed out, is that you need to avoid greenwashing. These artificial reefs cannot be used to compensate for impacts that are happening to natural ecosystems. So if you're going to build a port, and that port's going to have a channel that's going to be dredged through a natural coral reef, you cannot put in an artificial reef and think that that's going to be a surrogate for what that natural reef was. Artificial reefs, as I said, will, yes, get corals, and they will get fishes and various other organisms. But the community composition of those artificial reefs is very different from what you get on natural reefs. And a lot of the ecosystem services that are provided by the natural coral reef won't exist on these artificial reefs, on top of some of the issues that we already talked about. And so when you think about this, the cost of many of these artificial reef programs, you might be better off actually putting in policies that focus instead on preservation or restoration of these natural habitats. And that's likely to be a lot more successful in meeting your sustainability objectives than putting in artificial reefs, which mm-hmm. don't make the surrogates for these natural habitats that are being impacted. And I'm not saying we need to stop all development and we can't impact natural ecosystems. I think the economic growth engine of every nation that surrounds this Gulf needs to continue. I'm just saying that we need to think about sustainability from a broader perspective in terms of ways that we can enhance that sustainability while minimizing environmental impacts. That's one, is that we should avoid, you know, using artificial reefs for greenwashing purposes. But as I mentioned, secondary objective that we think people should consider is listing the goals. So when you can put down very clear goals for these artificial reef programs, that makes it then easier to put in place the next recommendation we have, which is defining very quantifiable, clear criteria that will allow you to assess your performance towards meeting those goals. And so, for example, if it's to enhance ecotourism, look at the number of boats that are going out, the number of divers that are getting in the water, the number of times these things are getting featured on social media, et cetera, et cetera. So what criteria that you can measure to assess the performance in meeting those goals. Then looking at using an interdisciplinary approach to design these artificial reefs towards those intended goals. You can build artificial reefs out of everything from like decommissioned oil rigs to a pile of tires to very complex 3D printed structures that extend from the bottom all the way to the surface. So how do you design it? Well, it really depends on what you want out of this. Is it more fishes? Is it a dive site for tourists, et cetera? And so getting engineers, ecologists, environmental scientists and oceanographers in the same room talking with each other about what works best for the least cost for these purposes will help. Our fifth recommendation is, okay, if you're going to build these and you have these very clear goals and criteria, now monitor. So even before you put the artificial reef in place, you should be out there surveying this area so you can document, yes, it's had a positive change on the environment and what those changes were in terms of the abundance of fishes, the diversity of fishes, et cetera, if that's the purpose of it. But you need to do that through time. And so assessing before and after the construction of this and then following it for a period of, typically it would be upwards of 3 years, possibly 5 years to assess, because of course the communities are going to change through time. When you first put in bare concrete, it's going to get settled on by bacteria, and then later on oysters, urchins, then corals, and all of the time fish communities will be changing on this. So it won't even reach maturity for probably 10 or 15 years. So you need to put in a good monitoring program to assess the effectiveness of the artificial reef in meeting those goals. And then the final recommendation is, and one of the big weaknesses we see in the Arabian region is that even where there are monitoring programs put in place, the results are put on a shelf and are not accessible to the public. But if that's the case, you don't learn from your mistakes, nor will anyone else. And so we highly recommend that people publicize, so through scientific publications or even non-scientific publications and reports, just putting them online to show how your artificial reef program worked or didn't work so that we can learn from that for the next iteration. So those are our six recommendations for policymakers and marine managers in the region. And we're hoping with those sort of reflections in mind, as well as the other content that we have in this report, that they'll be able to put together much more effective and sustainable approaches to developing artificial reef programs in the future.
So what I'm hearing really is that the artificial reefs have a huge potential to help mitigate a lot of the challenges that the Arabian Wolf is experiencing when it comes to its marine ecosystems. But we just need to be conscious and aware about how we're using them and making sure that they're being used in a way that isn't damaging the ecosystem that is currently there.
That's right. Yeah, artificial reefs do have a lot of possible benefits, but I like to consider them a double-edged sword. And if you don't think about the other side of that sword, you can run into all sorts of... So as long as people are cognizant of the potential risks and then try and minimize those risks so that they're not going to come up in the future, they can have a lot of benefits for coastal communities, both economic as well as through biodiversity benefits. So I think it's just a matter of people sitting down and thinking through the programs in great detail before they actually go and enact them. As I said from the top, artificial reefs conceptually are very easy because you just take a pile of stuff and drop it in the sea. But there's all sorts of consequences from that that might be unintended.
You know, we're coming to the end of our discussion today, but if someone's listening to this and they're considering implementing an artificial reef in their area, what would be the first thing that you would want to tell them?
Well, I'd tell them to go on the Alcasami Foundation website and download the paper that's there by John Burt et al. On policy considerations. We have a lot of information that's in there that details these benefits and these potential negative consequences that need to be considered. And I think if you put a program in place that's like that, you're looking at world-class best practices. This program that we've recommended here is what is the gold standard being used around the world right now. And so you get a lot from just that paper. And I'm very happy to meet and talk with folks who are considering these sort of things and just want to informally just talk about the program, what they want out of the program, and how they can best meet those goals. So please do get in contact. But also just be aware of, you know, we've got this beautiful natural system off of our shores. Let's do what's right to keep it enhanced for future generations.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's an excellent recommendation to go read the paper. And then finally, you know, for the general public, what's the one thing that you'd want just the average listener to go away thinking about or considering after this podcast?
The big takeaway for the general public would be, you know, marine systems are dynamic. They're fluid systems that are constantly changing and moving and interacting with various other systems that are around them. And so trying to simplify solutions that are quite complex problems into a single factor isn't going to work. Artificial reefs do have potential benefits when properly managed, and they can be used, but that's one tool in the whole decision-making toolbox. And I think there's a lot more that that both decision makers and the general public can be doing. And I think the biggest one is if you're an individual, do what you can to preserve the environment, be it in the one that you're sitting on right now, or if you're out at the sea. Everything that we put in our toilets will eventually end up in the sea here in the UAE, because that's where our sewage treatment plant goes. So think of the microplastics that are in your facial scrub and we'll go from there.
Thank you. Well, that's it. So that's all we've got time for on this episode. Thank you so much for joining me, John, and sharing your boundless expertise with us.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be here. And again, to any listeners who are out there interested in the marine environment, please look up the Burt Lab at New York University Abu Dhabi for more info.
Yeah, well, if you'd like to find out more about John's work with artificial reefs and the conservation of coastal ecosystems, as we've said, you can check out his policy paper on our website, www.alkasmifoundation.com. And if you'd like to get in touch about what you've heard on the podcast today, you can email me at ethan@alkasemidfoundation.rac.ae. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next month. Goodbye.